Hi, Casey. Nice to see you here today.
Hi, Kevin.
One of the things I think be useful to talk about today is kind of a big issue these days, Social Security. And can you put that in some perspective for us and kind of say what should people think about on Social Security? Is it going to be around for them in the future? And what's going to determine the shape of where it's headed and where it's been?
A lot of people ask me that, will Social Security be around when I'm old? And I think they have in mind really the budget constraint for the government that when there aren't many workers per old person, how can we afford to treat the old generously? And that's certainly true at some extreme, but that may not be the relevant question for people your age. Because there'll still be number of workers per old person when you're old, not as many as there are now. And as we see from European countries who've gotten about that old before we did, they didn't have to cut benefits per old person. Pretty much these programs expanded at the rate that the elderly population expanded. So my guess based on the international history of the program is the benefits will be about the same as they are now. I can't tell you whether they'll be in the form of monetary pensions or medical benefits or housing programs. But as we saw Germany age, Italy age, and Spain age, they didn't cut benefits. They didn't even cut benefits in hidden ways like raising the retirement age or taxing the benefits back, things like that. So that's what the data seem to suggest, and you can see theory pushing in that direction, namely that the old get to be a bigger group, a group that's more affluent and healthy. They might be politically active and be able to protect their program pretty well.
Okay, so what you're saying is, in some sense, we don't have to rely just on extrapolation or some unknown forecast. We can actually look at what's actually happened. There are places around the world that have experienced the kind of aging that we've seen already. And we haven't seen a crisis there where the elderly had to do without.
That's right.
But obviously these benefits still have to be paid. So that must mean there's an increasing burden on the young people. So are you
That's
telling
right.
me my kids ought to worry rather than I ought to worry? Is that what you're telling
Exactly.
me?
Yes. The taxes will be increased to maintain the benefits per elderly person spread over more elderly people. And that's what we've seen in European countries. But we know when we get to an extreme where the elderly outnumber the working population, that can't happen. But that's not an extreme we're getting near in this country, in your generation.
Anytime soon. So
Anytime soon.
maybe in 100 years we might be there, but
Right.
in the foreseeable future we're a long ways away from that.
Yes.
Now, is that going to create a problem for the younger generation, though? I mean, the elderly, it seems to me, are even more affluent today relative to the younger generation than they've ever been. And even the private market side of things, I think, is going to be headed in that same direction. And so what you're telling me is that relative status of the elderly and the younger generations, you think is going to continue to move in that direction without, that's what the data suggest?
I think so. In European countries, the elderly are doing maybe even better than the younger people. Many of them are. Of course, there's differences among elderly, like there are differences among younger people.
Now, do you think families are going to offset this in some way by the elderly giving back more to their children, either in inheritances or giving them more when they're young or other things like that might offset that?
That seems likely. We've seen it even in our country as working age people are less likely to provide housing for their parents and things like that, more independent living for elderly people. And so there's some obvious margins in which that's occurred.
Don't we even see some of it going the other way with, you know, more 30-year-olds living at home with mom and
Yeah.
dad, or in Europe, you know, people staying at home, coming back to home after school and things like that. So maybe what we'll see is not so much a change among the elderly, but maybe a change among the youth.
Yeah, they'll have to be. They'll be paying tax rates a fair bit higher than we have now. Europeans, not unheard of to have a 40% tax on the payroll.
Now, does that commonly happen in economics that, you know, you push on one part of the economy and the implications that you see come up someplace maybe you might not have guessed? I mean, it seems to me that's kind of one of the things economists often do find is that, you know, the obvious consequences aren't necessarily the ones that actually transpire, that maybe when things work their way through, you kind of see something a little different. So this seems to be another one of those cases.
I hope we have some value to add to the layman.
Yeah, sometimes the layman does serve as a reality check on what we do, but hopefully sometimes we actually do have something to bring into the picture. Do you see a political fight coming on Social Security down the road? Do you see that this is going to be an important political topic in the U.S. for years to come? Or do you, for example, right now we have the President's Commission thinking about overhauling Social Security. Is privatization a big deal?
Yeah, is that a big deal? Well, there's two kinds of privatization I like to think about. One is the kind of privatization we've seen in a few countries around the world where we lay out really a 75-year plan for the economy, and at the end of that trajectory, what happens is elderly people pay for themselves. The government doesn't pay them anymore. The second kind of privatization I see involves such a plan and actually sticking to it. And those are two very different things. We don't have much experience in the world with a country actually following through with these 75-year plans. What can easily happen and has happened is after the plan, we're getting closer to the end of the plan, political forces and other forces change the plan in such a way that the elderly still collect funds from the government and the young still pay to support those programs.
So what you're telling me is commitments are difficult to keep, that there's, you know, in a political environment, you can think you close the book on an issue, but whatever political forces are there are still going to continue to operate, even if you
yes.
think we settled this issue 50 years ago.
Yeah, I'd say two things. First of all, privatization is a commitment. We shouldn't ignore that. It involves commitment, and then second of all, commitments, we need some mechanism by which those commitments can be kept, and that's a hard thing that I haven't seen a country solve yet.
So you're saying it might, privatization is an effort toward making a commitment to do certain things, and there's some ability to commit, but we've yet to see a commitment that's been even close to fully effective.
Yes.
Okay, now you mentioned before that the European countries have seen what the U.S. has coming already. Well, what do they have coming? They have even worse ratios coming down the road earlier than us?
Yeah, they're ahead of us in the aging dimension, and will stay ahead of us, depending on what happens to things like immigration and things like that. But they're likely to stay ahead of us, and they'll have a tougher problem, more elderly per worker than even we will have. They still won't be to the point where the elderly outnumbers the workers, but that budget constraint will be pushing harder. And it'll be interesting to see how far we go in that direction before benefits are cut for elderly and taxes are not used to make up all the difference.
So what you're telling me is for the U.S. we have data that we can actually appeal to. In the case of Europe, we don't really have the data because the guy on the leading edge of the curve is blazing new territory.
Yes.
And so the theory might say that we might expect more of the same, but the theory also tells us that at some point maybe just the sheer reality of the budget constraint may really have to start pushing a somewhat different outcome.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, one, and I guess I can say more about how soon that will happen. I mean, one thing to think about is a Laffer curve for taxes and what kinds of tax rates they would need to support elderly benefits at the rate they have. And as I mentioned, these countries have 40% tax rates already. Can they have 60% tax rates or 70? Maybe not. Whereas in the U.S. case, we know that since other countries have done it, we could do it too. We could have a 30% tax rate without violating any laws of economics or anything like that.
No, how does that depend on, you know, but remember, old age support's not all these countries are trying to do. I mean, does it matter how much they're trying to do on other margins? That is, the total tax rate as opposed to just the tax rate
yes.
to support the elderly. So do you see that the need to do more taxation in order to support the elderly, do you see that as having an effect on the ability of government to address other issues and the ability of government to use tax revenues for education or other things that society might have pressure on the government to do?
Yes, I think that can happen. Even in the United States, it's hard to say what would happen if we hadn't aged. But really, almost all of the growth in government spending at the federal level, for example, is on elderly. Thereby, the arithmetic says there wasn't growth on average in the non-elderly programs. By elderly programs, I mean Medicare, pensions, big part of Medicaid.
And now that's a change from what happened in the earlier part of the century, right? In the earlier part of the century, I thought we had growth in both.
Yes.
Growth in spending on the elderly and growth in spending on the young, and they kind of kept pace with one another for a while. But we've seen a divergence there where the elderly have continued to grow and spending on the young has kind of leveled off. Is that
yes.
is that a fair way to say it?
Yes. And of course, it's hard to say what would have happened otherwise, but it's likely that the programs for the youth might have grown more if aging hadn't occurred the way it did.
So once again, we see that the effects are going to happen in areas maybe not so obviously related to Social Security. So the growth in the Social Security burden might affect the youth and that they have to pay higher taxes, but also might affect the youth because we'll have fewer programs directed at them as well.
Yes.
So right. I really ought to worry about my children. Is that's what you're telling me? That, you know, maybe my concern not shouldn't be so much whether I'll have the money to retire, but whether they'll be able to afford to support my retirement.
Yes.
Okay, that's pretty neat. Now, this kind of pushes in the direction of benefits to the elderly. Now, currently in the United States, we're talking about expanding benefits to the elderly, not so much in terms of higher direct pensions, but in terms of things like a prescription drug benefit program for the elderly, or expanded Medicaid, Medicare for the elderly as the expenditures on healthcare continue to rise. How does that fit into the equation? Does that add to the burden, or is that a big part of the story, you think?
I would think of a general package for the elderly population without making much distinction myself between pensions and Medicare, things like that. But I wondered, is it a good idea to expand Medicare or a good idea to have this prescription drug package rather than some other type of spending on the elderly? What do you think about that?
I guess I'm of two minds. I think one thing is, if you think about what's happened for the elderly, the growth in medical technology and the growth in our ability to deal with disease and other issues of health is really an incredible opportunity for older individuals to live better, longer lives. And in the one sense, you might say, well, shouldn't we have a program that allows people to take advantage of that? And the answer is, well, I think as an economist, I'd say, well, it's like all other opportunities that come place in the market. Yeah, people should be able to take advantage of it, but people should have to pay for it as well, because society has to pay in any case. And now one argument could be, well, the people who are old today didn't know that all these opportunities were going to be available. They didn't know that there was going to be so much candy in the candy store available, and therefore they didn't save enough to take advantage of what was there. And what we need to do is give them that opportunity, give them the resources that they need to take full advantage of the benefits that are currently available. I think that's a rather nice short-run argument. I think the tougher question is, is, given what we've seen with Social Security, given what we've seen in existing areas of Medicare, do we really want to get the government involved in this part of providing for the elderly as the government has become involved in Social Security? Or do we think that at least the partial commitment provided by a more private system would in fact serve us better down the road and insulate us from some of the political forces? Therefore, I think we're faced with a tough question. If we could have a temporary program that would only provide for people for a while that we could then transit away from, I think that that would be good. I think politically, that's a very, very difficult thing to do. So that's the one side, kind of a macro level way of thinking about whether we should get involved in something like prescription drug coverage or an expansion of Medicare generally. Now, there's another more kind of micro argument, which is to say, look, right now we're paying for physicians, hospitals, all these other aspects of healthcare. And therefore, what we're doing is subsidizing one method of curing people's ailments without and not helping at all to pay for drugs. And as an economist, we know that's going to distort people's behavior, that they're going to do more of the stuff that they don't have to pay for relative to the stuff that they do have to pay for. So maybe even though from society's point of view, a drug therapy is a cheaper way to treat a disease, people won't choose that method because they have to pay for that themselves, whereas they can get the rest of us to foot the bill for a doctor and so forth. So that would argue that maybe covering prescription drugs could actually reduce our overall health cost.
Do you have an example of that? That's interesting.
Examples of where you would want it, where you could actually save money in prescription drug coverage. Any particular ones you would
For example, not necessarily the wonderful case of where you could save money, but cases where people are maybe tilted too much toward hospital treatment versus prescription treatment.
Okay, so for example, one of the things might be cholesterol-reducing drugs. For example, if I could take a cholesterol-reducing drug that would cost me so much per year, say $500 a year or whatever, and that would allow me to avoid a very expensive bypass surgery or something down the road that would cost $100,000, we might be better off saying, let's pay the $500 a year and avoid the $100,000 bypass surgery down the road. So that would be an example where we might have an efficient substitution toward drugs. So we would have to incur the out-of-pocket cost of the cholesterol-reducing drugs, but at the same time, we'd capture the benefits of fewer people needing the surgery. Of course, they can also go together. So for example, a case where it goes in the opposite direction is we come up with drugs that help prevent rejection of transplants. Well, as a result of the coming up with drugs, we actually are going to do more transplants. We're going to do transplants in cases where we wouldn't have done them before. And as we know, transplant surgery is very, very expensive. So in that case, actually covering the drug therapy would actually raise costs rather than lower costs. So it's not as simple as it doesn't always go one way. I think there's an issue here where maybe what we'd like to do is maybe not raise the overall rate of coverage for healthcare costs, because I think one of the problems we have today is that one reason we spend more on healthcare is because people on the margin are not paying the additional cost. When I go to the doctor, I don't pay the additional amount that's picked up by Medicare, private insurance, or whatever. So if we were to just add on prescription drug coverage to that, in some sense, we're picking up an even bigger chunk of overall healthcare costs, and that could actually make matters worse. What seems to make more sense would be to maybe raise the copayment on other things and increase the amount that we pay of drugs and kind of more level the pricing between doctor, hospital, and drug therapies, which would, we think, give us a more efficient mix of the different therapies without having an increased rate of subsidy toward healthcare generally.
So do more to help people pay for their drugs and a little less to help them pay their doctor bills.
I think that would make some sense. Now, one of the things with drugs that I think is important, though, and we should talk about Medicare in general, is, remember, it is an insurance program. And the whole idea of insurance is that what we try to do is smooth out people's expected payments. So what you want to have is I make a regular payment for car insurance and I pay, you know, $1,000 a year in car insurance rather than have every once in a while a $30,000 bill if I happen to wreck my automobile. So what I've done is I've insured myself by pooling the risk across me and everybody else of whether we're going to have an accident. So I think one of the problems we've gotten to in the healthcare area is we've forgotten that we're talking about insurance. So if every person has a $500 per year expenditure that they need to make on healthcare, that's not the goal of insurance to pay for that $500, because all we're doing then is making everybody throw $500 into a kitty and then we just transfer the $500 back to everybody. That's not accomplishing the goal of insurance. So I would like to see us, if we do have a prescription drug coverage, at least try to do it in a way that focuses more on insurance, that is covering people who, because of their health conditions, have a very large prescription drug coverage and not focus so much on first dollar coverage. Because I think, you know, first dollar coverage isn't what insurance is all about.
So people on the plan shouldn't be making a claim. Every person shouldn't make a claim every month.
Yeah, I think that's basically right. Now some people are going to have claims every month who are on some kind of maintenance drug therapy that maybe involves a $500 a month bill or $1,000 a month. Then those people clearly would have most of their expenditures covered. But, you know, our goal here is not that people have zero expenditures out of pocket on healthcare. Our goal is that people will not be impoverished because they have a health emergency. I think that's, we get back to that way of thinking about healthcare, I think we'll make things better off. We also would like to think that by doing that, maybe we're going to cut down on some of the expenditures that aren't so necessary. That is, you know, if you try to say, what are the expenditures that I have control over, the things that I can do? Well, the catastrophes probably I have less control over than whether I go to the doctor or not, if I'm feeling a little ill on a day, if I have some other condition that makes me, you know, it's the minor conditions where I think there's a more responsiveness of people to the co-payments and prices, and maybe where these kind of improved pricing incentives might actually have the greatest benefit. You know, say for example, among younger people, I mean, you know, there's not too much price responsiveness for appendicitis, right? I mean, you're either gonna, if you have an appendicitis, probably you're gonna get it treated. If you don't have one, you're probably not gonna go in and get one when you don't need it. On the other hand, therapy, physical therapy, because my knee's bothering me, is something where it's more likely to be responsive. If I don't have to foot the bill, and I don't have to pay anything for it, and my knee's a little sore, I'm going to go to the physical therapist for 6 weeks and get some therapy. Regardless, you know, if I'm not paying the bill, I don't care if it's $100 a day and it only makes me feel a little bit better, it's still worth it. I get off work, I get to go do some few other things. It's something I enjoy. That's going to be more price sensitive than treatment for appendicitis.
You know? So a Medicare deductible could save Medicare a lot of money.
I think so. I think not just Medicare deductible. One of the things we also have to worry about is the other coverages that people get that wrap around Medicare. So if Medicare has a deductible and then they go out and get private insurance that undoes some of those deductible features, that can actually be very counterproductive, because now people don't even face the incentives that are inherent in the system itself. And I think with prescription drug coverage, one of the issues also comes in, we have currently a lot of people who have private insurance prescription drug coverage. Depending on how you structure the public provision, you're either going to draw all those people into the public system, or if we structure it in a different way, they might stay on the own private system. And the question is, do we really want to suck everybody into the public system? Is that in our collective interest? And, you know, there's a lot of complicated issues there, but I guess my gut feeling would be no. I think I would rather preserve some kind of diversity of plans out there so there's at least some forms of competition between alternative plans available. I don't think a one-size-fit-all program would necessarily be the way to go.
Now, it seems to me, I'm not an expert on healthcare, but it seems to me that healthcare costs keep rising and rising. Am I right about that?
I would say healthcare expenditures keep rising and rising. I saying expenditures rise and costs rise to an economist is not really the same thing. That what you mean by cost rising is people spend more on healthcare at a given age today than they did in the past. It's also true that people spend more on computers today than they did in the past. That doesn't mean that the cost of computers is going up through time. In fact, the cost of computers we know is actually falling, but because the price is falling, actually people are spending more. In economics, we would say that's because demand is elastic. That is, the quantity that I want is responds to the price that I observe. In the healthcare case, I would say not so much that cost is rising, but the opportunities are increasing and people are buying more of those now more available opportunities. That's part of it. Well, the other reason we're spending more on healthcare is demographics. We know we spend more on per capita on elderly people than we do on young people, and we're getting older. And in some sense, health progress creates its own problem, because the more you keep older people alive, the more 80-year-olds you have, the more you're going to spend on healthcare, because 80-year-olds spend a lot more on healthcare than 60-year-olds spend on healthcare. So as we make progress, healthcare, quote, costs are going to rise. That doesn't mean keeping people alive is a bad thing, right? I mean, it's a good thing that people are alive that would otherwise not be. But we should realize that a lot of the growth in what we call cost is really growth in consumption. Now, where does that come into play? Well, that comes into play in terms of how I think, for example, about prescription drug coverage for the elderly. You notice when I talked about prescription drug coverage for the elderly, I didn't say, isn't it a horrible world? Prescription drugs are getting more expensive. We have to do something to help out the elderly. I don't think that's the right story. The right story is there's all these new things available that were not available 20 years ago. And we would like to allow the elderly to take advantage of those things. But I think it's important to keep that in perspective, that we're really saying, what can we do to allow today's elderly to take advantage of the improved opportunities, not what can we do to rescue them from this horrible world of accelerating costs of prescription drugs. And it really, I think that's the right perspective to put on it.
Even your family and mine, probably every year we've paid more toward our health insurance than in the past. But you're saying that we're getting more for it.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look over the long term in the United States, and whether we compare 2000 and 1900, or whether we compare 2000 and 1980, or 1990 and 1970, two things have really happened in the U.S. We've gotten wealthier. That is, our real levels of income, our real standard of living has risen. At the same time, we've gotten healthier. That is, we've lived longer, we're healthier at any given age than we were in the past. And in some work that Bob Topel and I have done, we've actually tried to quantify in dollar terms what the gains have been from each of those two things. How much have we gained because we're wealthier and have more fax machines and computers and better movies and all kinds of other material things. And we've asked, how much better are we today because we're healthier and live longer than we are in the past? The answer is, it's a horse race between those two things, that the improvements in longevity and health have added just about as much to improve people's livelihoods as has improvements in material wealth. Both have been tremendous and both have been large. And that's true whether I compare 2000 and 1960 or I compare 2000 and 1900. Of course, both improvements are much greater over the longer horizon than over the shorter horizon. But still, I think the mix is on the same rough order of magnitude. Now, one way to think about it is, I give you your choice. I'm going to take you back to 1900. You can either say 1900 income and keep your health that you have today, or take 1900 health and keep the income you have today. And the question is, which one would you rather have? You know, remember in 1900, you probably, income was, you know better than me, you're a macroeconomist, but a relatively small fraction of what income is today. Of course, life expectancy was probably 30 years less in 1900 than it is today. So would you like to give up those 30 years, or would you like to give up that additional material wealth that you have today?
That's a tough choice.
It is a tough choice. And same is true if we compare 2000 and 1970. You know, we're healthier and live longer today, and we have more material wealth today. And if you ask me which one I'd rather give up, I think it's a very tough choice. Fortunately, we don't have to make that choice. Fortunately, we've gotten both of those. That gets us into another issue that I think is important, which is the cost of healthcare. And, you know, traditionally, if you talk to people about healthcare policy, there's two very different camps. There's one camp that thinks, well, what we really need to do is do more to improve healthcare. That is, spend money on research to come up with a cure for cancer, or better ways to treat AIDS, or better ways to treat heart disease. Then there's the other crowd, which is all about cost containment. Well, we're going to go broke. We can't afford what we're doing now, and it's not slowing down, so we have to do cost containment. One thing that I think is that cost containment and research are really complementary, that really what you want to do is do some of both. If we can keep people from spending their money on things that are not cost effective, then research seems like a very attractive alternative. We can get more of those kind of gains that Bob and I talked about in the past without having the danger of overconsumption that would tend to impoverish us down the road. Now, of course, all this takes money. It takes money to do all these things. You know, and the government, you know, has to come with that money from somewhere. And that brings us to one of the most dreaded words in many people's vocabulary, which is taxes. Where are we headed on taxes? You think taxes are, what's going on with taxes? Are people, are we going to see taxes rise, taxes go down? Is taxation going to stay with us or become a bigger part of my life? Or is the tax man going to finally leave me alone?
Well, I mentioned that the programs for the elderly are going to continue to grow about in proportion with their numbers, which are projected to grow a lot. So there'll be taxes growing for that reason. And for that reason, it's tempting to try to make the tax system better.
Okay.
To try to collect the $2 trillion a little less painfully than we have been. And we've had proposals for flatter tax systems, for federal sales tax systems.
Now people propose a flat tax. A flat tax a good idea? I mean, why would people think a flat tax is better than the system, or what's the alternative to a flat tax?
The flat tax and the federal sales tax are proposed as alternative to our current tax system, which seems complicated, has loopholes, and encourages certain types of behavior, certain oil well drilling, certain types of business, discourages other types of behavior.
Okay, so now when you're saying a flat tax, there's really a couple of elements of a flat tax. One is how you tax different kinds of activities, whether we tax all activities equally. Then there's a separate question about how does the level of taxes related to my level of income?
Yes.
When you talk about flat tax, are you saying we should have a constant tax rate for all income levels? Or are you saying a flat tax in the sense that we ought to tax the proceeds from oil wells the same way we tax the proceeds from running a grocery store and the same way we tax other activities?
Well, they have a lot in common from my point of view. And what they have in common is whether you flatten the tax by treating activities on a more level playing field, or you flatten the tax by cutting rates on the rich. In either case, it's easier to raise tax revenue. The reason being, in the first case, it's easy to see because taxes would not have the effect of changing from one activity to another. In the second case, it's maybe a little harder to see until you recognize that so much of taxes are paid by the rich. So when the rich can behave more efficiently, that makes it easier to raise revenue from them in particular, and therefore revenue in general. But that brings up one of these secondary effects are effects that the layman might not notice that I'm concerned about, which is if taxes were made more painless, maybe that would be another reason to have more taxes. And we've seen that in history as well, as with the Social Security tax. It's one of the less painful taxes we have. Why? Because it is flat. There's one rate for everyone. It's all-inclusive when it comes to labor income. There's not you can't deduct your home mortgage from your Social Security tax. You can't deduct your muni bond interest, etc., from the payroll tax. So it's a painless tax. Also, many people don't see it. Part of it doesn't even appear on your paycheck that you pay. It's paid by your employer. So it seems like a painless tax, and it's a tax that's always been increased and never cut. One of the nice side effects of a painful tax is that people will fight back against increasing it. And so I think that needs to be kept in mind. There's going to be some way to control the growth of taxes. We want to make sure that they still have a little pain to them.
Okay, so what you're telling me, and I'm trying to make sure I understand this, what you're saying is, if you just thought about for a given level of spending or a given size of government taxes, the most efficient tax or the tax that a flat tax is going to be good. It's a lower cost method of raising revenues. But on the other hand, given you have a lower cost method of obtaining taxes, you're going to tend to do more of that. And what you're afraid is that maybe taxes would expand as a result of that. Now, how about somebody who thought that government spending was a great idea, that they thought government should be bigger, and would they have the opposite view of what you're saying, that in fact a more efficient tax has now double benefits? It's more efficient for a given level of taxation and allows us to have more taxation, which is also good. Would that be a logical conclusion of?
Yes, it's kind of a paradox. The flat tax at first might seem unfair, especially to the extent that it lowers tax rates on the rich. But it would be a great revenue source. Instead of collecting $2 trillion, we could collect $3 trillion with about the same amount of resistance from the taxpayers. And one could imagine a lot of good things you could do with an extra $1 trillion.
So the same people who, so neither side of the aisle ought to be comfortable with how they ought to vote on this issue. That on the one hand, you know, if I'm a traditional Republican type, I would say, well, I like the flat tax because it helps my guys out. But on the other hand, maybe it's going to contribute to spending, which I don't like.
Yes.
People on the other side of the aisle will say helping the bad guys, but on the other hand, maybe at the same time, it's going to allow us to spend more, which I like.
It's a funny trade-off, but a real one.
Now, isn't that trade-off a little similar to the trade-off we see on the deficit and paying off the debt? Like whether we think the government ought to run a deficit these days, or whether it ought to raise taxes as a way of eliminating the deficit? Doesn't that same issue come up?
Similar analysis applies there. I think you're right. That on one hand, the fiscal conservative would like to see budgets balanced. A household has to balance its budget. Why doesn't the government have to balance its budget? On the other hand, when you hand a deficit and high levels of debt over to the next president, he's not going to be able to expand his programs the way he might have otherwise. So a fiscal conservative might like a deficit in terms of the way it controls people who succeed him, who might not be of his party or of his point of view. And we've seen the Republican Party, for example, alternate over time on its view on deficits. Ronald Reagan seemed to like them. And some of the logic at the time was, well, pork barrel programs are going to have trouble growing under the shadow of a lot of government debt.
Right. So, and the other side of the aisle kind of switched their position as well. But they seem to be the fiscal conservatives of today who say, well, we need to get rid of the deficit. So what you're saying is again, this kind of not so obvious consequences may be something that has a real effect. It's actually shaping the changing debate in Washington over what we do on tax policy.
You're right.
So that's kind of a theme that's run through everything we've talked about today, which is that one thing economics can help us do is see some effects and maybe things that are important that aren't obvious if you just don't think about it using those tools.
If we're successful, we'll help people do that.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot. This has been fun.
Thank you, Kevin.